Hey, this episode of the Majority Report is sponsored by Igloo. Igloo is an intranet that you'll actually like. It's a cloud platform that can help you do your best work. You can share files, blog updates, coordinate calendars, and manage projects. It's super easy to use. So whether you're a large enterprise stuck using SharePoint or a fast-growing business overwhelmed by apps, create an intranet that matches your brand's look and feel and simplifies how you work and is accessible on your phone. Sign up now. Try it for free at igloosoftware.com/majority. That's igloosoftware.com/majority.
You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, January 29th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of psychology at Swarthmore College, Barry Schwartz, on his book, The Paradox of Choice, and also a little bit on how market freedom erodes the best things in life. Also on the program today, President Obama releases, or we should say, there are reports about the release of the upcoming administration budget, which calls for an estimated 6.8% increase in discretionary spending. Interesting. Also on the program today, the Obama administration opens up Southern Atlantic Coast to offshore drilling. Yes.
We've been pushing for that for a while.
Oh, there you go. Enjoy those tar deposits and oil spills. Carolinas and Georgia. And then, of course, New Jersey and Long Island Sound and the Cape. That'll be nice. And the Koch brothers announce a record-smashing $900 million they plan to spend in the 2016 election. Let that sink in, folks. We know the Republicans and the Democrats more or less each spent $1 billion in 2012. Well, now there's a new sheriff in town. And the question is, who's going to get a bunch of that money? Meanwhile, measles continue to spread on the West Coast because anti-vaxxers don't want to get vaccinations for their kids against measles. Whereas Ebola slowing, but also a report that it may have mutated. Israel and Hezbollah seemingly don't want to go to war, despite the fact that we know Bibi's got a re-election to win. And the story of the Friendship Nine, almost 50 years later, had their convictions overturned. That and more on today's program. Folks, just a reminder, we have only a couple more days left for you to nominate us at podcastawards.com. podcastawards.com. That is where we hopefully will get nominated to win either the People's Choice Award or Best News in Politics. Or, I mean, you could nominate us for both, actually, and do so, because in a week we're going to start asking you on a daily basis to vote for us. And I think it's one of those things you can vote as many times as you want. I'm not 100% sure about that. I think nominations, you only get one crack at nominations, but I think you can vote as many times as you want. I'm not sure about that. But we'll see. Or once a day, I think that's what
I recall.
Yes. I don't know if they have the same rules. But we will be asking you to do that for us. And I will forestall asking you to become a member to support the program because of it. But this is interesting. For those of you who have a fairly large business or a small enterprise where you're dealing with a bunch of people, like it would work theoretically here in this office if I actually had some confidence that Matt and Michael would actually access the system. But the program's being sponsored today by Igloo. It's an intranet that, if you've ever experienced an intranet before, this one you're actually going to like. This is basically a private internet for people, you know, a group that you set up, and it can be, you know, your coworkers. It's a cloud platform that allows you to share files, update blogs, coordinate calendars, manage projects. It would be perfect for this business if I thought that Matt and Mike, I wouldn't be the only person posting and looking at stuff there. Because it's easy to use, easy to configure, even for the least non-technical or the most non-technical of users, which Michael aspires to be even that level of grade of non-technical user. It's built using a very responsive design, which means everything you can do at your desk, you can now do on the go or on your phone. So, for instance, Michael, you're out. You're just about to go to your yoga class after having a glass of Chablis. All right. You could just check on your phone.
Finally.
So whether you're a large enterprise stuck using SharePoint, I don't know what SharePoint is, but it sounds like a mess. Or if you're a fast-growing business like this one, or even one that is like not fast-growing like this one, but incrementally growing, you can create an intranet that matches your brand's look and feel and simplifies how you work. And it's accessible, like I say, on your phone. Sign up now. Try it for free at igloosoftware.com/majority. That's igloosoftware.com/majority. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Barry Schwartz. Oh, and later in the program, I'll explain where I was yesterday, because tonight there's a program-long, the entire episode of All In with Chris Hayes tonight, assuming no big news breaks, is going to be this, basically this draft for candidates. I'll explain it all later, but let me just tell you something. I cleaned up. So check it out tonight at 8 p.m. Chris Hayes. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Barry Schwartz.
Driving on 9, I sure miss you. Past the motel, looking at the pines. Driving on 9, look for 1:30. Maybe I passed it. Going.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor Barry Schwartz, psychology professor at Swarthmore College and author of The Paradox of Choice and How Market Freedom Erodes the Best Things in Life. Welcome to the program, Barry.
Hi, nice to be with you.
So let's talk about the and I have to say that I'm fascinated by your book. I mean, it's obviously it came out some time ago. I don't know why it's most recently come to my attention, but I'm fascinated by it because one of my favorite fiction books was by John Barth, and it was called End of the Road. And in many respects, it really covers sort of this idea of choice being paralyzing in some respects, but before we get there, I mean, tell us, what does that mean, the paradox of choice?
Well, so what it means is that almost everyone's intuition and economists' absolute theoretical commitment is that more choice has to be better than less, and the reason is that if you don't care about having 100 cereals to choose from, you'll ignore 98 of them. If you do care, there they are. So every new cereal that gets added is going to make somebody better off. It makes nobody worse off. And how could that not be true? So that's what we all take for granted. The paradox is that that's not necessarily the case, that when you keep adding options, people don't ignore them, and instead of being liberated by them, at least some of the time, they're paralyzed. They choose none of the above. They can't pull the trigger. So it's paradoxical. You give people more and more freedom, and yet they feel less and less free.
And let's talk about some of the studies that that came to that allowed you to come to your conclusions in this book. I mean, I know at one point there was some questioning of the underlying research. Just address. No, go ahead.
Well, the first study has become quite famous is the JAM study, where you put out 24 different flavors of a new expensive jam in a gourmet food store. People can sample as many flavors as they want, and if they do, they get a coupon that will give them $1 off on any jam they buy. And a few days later, you put out 6 flavors, not 24. And once again, if you sample, you get a coupon that will save you $1. And more people come to the table and try things when there are 24 jams than when there are 6, but a tenth as many people actually buy jam. And the explanation is that when you see 24 jams, you don't know which jam to buy, so you end up buying none. And the same thing has been shown with 401k plans with real money and real employees working for real companies. The more mutual fund options you make available to your employees, the less likely they are to participate.
And so, I mean, what are the implications of this? Or rather, I should say, you know, why is it that, give us some sense of where this fits in from a policy standpoint.
Well, from a policy standpoint, what it suggests is that you want to find out in any given domain where the sweet spot is. So giving people no choice is certainly not desirable either to the people or to anybody else, right? People want some freedom of choice, but knowing that choice is good doesn't mean that more choice is better. So what you want is to figure out how much choice is the right amount of choice for people to feel like they're free to try to satisfy their preferences and not be so overwhelmed that they just forget about the whole thing. And so as a policy matter, what I'd be doing, the Medicare prescription drug plan that rolled out, maybe 5 years ago, where, you know, in each state, private insurers offered prescription drug plans to senior citizens. And most states, there were 50, 60, 70 plans to choose from. And even though people were getting a huge gift from the government, you had to bully people into signing up. And the reason is that they couldn't figure out which plan to choose. So to me, it's crazy to offer 70 plans. Offer 6 plans. Have some entity filter the options and present people with, you know, what, the six best plans or the six most representative plans or something like that, so they feel empowered to choose instead of paralyzed. So for me, the policy implication is that you actually need to do the work to figure out how many options will in fact liberate people and not paralyze them, and then try to organize things so that that's about how many options they have. You know, in the supermarket, where policy doesn't really enter into this, if you're just a, you know, a manufacturer, what you want to do is figure out how many versions of your product is the right number of versions that everybody feels like they can find something and nobody feels like it's not worth the trouble.
So, all right. So on one hand, I mean, we're talking about something that has applications in the context of marketing, right? But on the other hand, we're also talking about something that an idea that has broader implications on sort of on the policy level, but also on sort of a philosophical or governmental ideological level. And let's talk about that, the latter there. I mean, in your 1994 book, I guess it was reissued in 2001, How Market Freedom Erodes the Best Things in Life, you're making that case a little bit more explicitly than I think in the paradox of choice.
No, that's right. That's right. So I think there are policy implications and also philosophical ones. And there's an idea that's growing in popularity and that various governments are actually starting to take seriously that's captured in a book that I didn't write called Nudge, that was written by Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein. And their argument is, look, you don't want to really restrict people's freedom, not in democratic societies. But what you want to do is pay attention to the choice architecture, that's their term, so that if people are paralyzed and they do nothing, they end up getting what they want or what's in their best interest. So, for example, the classic example is organ donation. Almost every American approves of organ donation, and 25% of Americans are organ donors. And the reason for this is that you become an organ donor by signing a form when you renew your driver's license. Well, how about if instead of that, you were an organ donor unless you sign a form that says you didn't want to be?
So it's an opt-out instead of an
opt-in. Opt-out versus opt-in. And in European countries that use opt-out, 98, 99% of citizens are organ donors versus 25% here. The same is true with retirement plans. The standard way that works is that you opt in. You give your employer permission to withhold some of your pay and put it into some instrument. How about if you reverse it and your employer will do that unless you tell them not to? You triple the rate of employee sign up for retirement plans. So their argument is that if you pay attention to the structure of the choice situation, you can take advantage of our tendency to be overwhelmed when there are too many options and essentially structure things so that people end up getting what's in their best interest or what they tell you on surveys is what they prefer. And so, you know, now a lot of people object to this. They call it nanny state. They call it paternalism. And their argument is, no. You have no business putting your finger on the scale as government. Just put the options out there and let people choose. And they act as if there's a neutral way of presenting options that doesn't bias people, push people in one direction or the other. And the truth is that there is no neutral. If you have an opt-in procedure, you bias people toward not participating. If you have an opt-out procedure, you bias people toward participating. There's no neutral. And I think this bothers a lot of people, particularly sort of libertarian-type people who think that freedom is the highest good, and what freedom means is that, you know, as many options as anyone can contemplate are out there, and we are completely free to choose among them. And any government intervention that restricts that freedom in any way, it should be opposed.
Just to play the devil's advocate, which I rarely do defend the libertarian position in this regard, I have to say. But I mean, how do you respond to the notion of, okay, you say, and I want to talk, that's on the sort of the supply side. I want to talk on the demand side too, the fact that not every person arrives to that decision making process with the same amount of information. But before we get there, how do you respond to the notion of, well, you say there's no neutral, but there is active versus passive, right? And so if you make everything opt out, then the government's being more active than it should be. I mean, how do you address that?
Well, I don't think there's any difference in how active the government is between opt-in and opt-out. Either way, the government is being active, pushing you in one direction or the other. There's a third possible scenario, which is you require people to choose. So when you get your driver's license, you can't opt-in, or it's neither opt-in nor opt-out. There are two boxes. One says I'm an organ donor, one says I'm not an organ donor, and you won't get your driver's license unless you choose one or the other. So you can require people to choose, and in that way, you know, you're not nudging people in one direction or the other.
Has there been like any research based on that type of scenario?
Yes, and that turns out when you do that, you get a organ donor participation that's midway between what you get when it's opt-in and what you get when it's opt-out. And you get 401k participation that's midway between what you get when it's opt-in and when what you get when it's opt-out. The mistake, though, people think that this is somehow less manipulative. But notice that here you are forcing people to choose. So you're still being paternalistic. You're saying, damn it, you have to choose. And I don't get to say, but I don't want to choose.
That's right. Right? I guess.
So it's just paternalistic about something else. But it's still you're still pushing people in a direction that they might not choose to go in on their own. So I think that the idea that there really is no neutral is something we have to try to get our heads around and accept. And then the question is, well, if there's no neutral, what criteria do you use for deciding which direction to nudge people in? Is it what you have independent reason to think is what they would choose if they were operating at their best? Is it something that would promote collective welfare? Is it some other thing? You know, that's an interesting conversation to have. What's your criterion for nudging people? But the notion that you can simply present an array of options without nudging people is, at this point, I would say, a bit naive.
And that criteria as to what makes you determine which way you're going to nudge people, that is basically just sort of your idea of how society should be at that point, right? I mean,
but in a democratic society, it seems to me this is a reasonable thing to be having a public conversation about.
Right.
You know, I mean, in the book that Thaler and Sunstein wrote, they're very, very cautious. They are reluctant to use nudges unless they have independent reason to believe they know what people's preferences are, right? So when you do surveys and you find out that 98% of Americans approve of organ donation, that authorizes them in their minds to use an opt-out procedure. People tell us this is what they want, so why not make it easy for them to get it? But if suppose they got a 50% approval of organ donation, now they would be much more reluctant to nudge people because they don't want to do it just because it's better for society. They want to do it because it's what people say they actually want. But we could imagine public conversations about what does improve general welfare and what doesn't, and which of these things are important enough that you want to nudge people in the direction of improving welfare, even if they themselves don't necessarily show that they support it. So, you know, if you believe that global warming is a problem and you want to try and make people more efficient in their use of energy, there are a variety of techniques that we know now will make people much more attentive to how much energy they use, you know, what they keep their thermostat set at and stuff like that. And we could implement these things, not forcing people to use less energy, but making it a lot easier for them to use less energy. And we could do that as a general policy, even though there will be some people who resent it.
Right.
And that seems to me is what we ought to be having public conversations about.
Right. Centered around that resentment. In other words, too often it seems to me within the context of our the way we analyze our politics, there's an assumption. In fact, President Obama did this in his State of the Union address. There's an assumption that we have these shared goals, and we're simply arguing over the best way to achieve those goals. But in fact, we already know how to achieve those goals. What we really are arguing over is what those goals are, and using the argument is supposedly how we achieve those goals as a sort of a proxy, because we, in many respects, I think there people don't want to have that argument about goals.
I think you're right, although I don't think that's true across the board. I think sometimes it really is an argument about means to common goals, but much of the time I think it masquerades as an argument about means when, in fact, people don't share the goals. I think you're right. And it's a lot harder to have a conversation about goals than it is to have a conversation about means.
Right.
It's not clear how you resolve disagreements about what the proper goals of government should be or what the proper goals of society should be.
Well, let's talk about this in the context of healthcare, because we have this notion that there's no neutral way of pushing, essentially. But there's also on the demand side, the person making the choice, not everybody enters into that choice situation with the same amount of information. There's an asymmetry, and in the context of healthcare, that seems to me to be one which has big implications, because the more libertarian, more conservative perspective on the way to reduce healthcare costs is we just have to give the patient more skin in the game so they can be a smart consumer and decide,
right,
I shouldn't have this MRI because it's going to be too expensive. But that doesn't really work, does it?
I think it's either willful naivete or just not willful. But you're right. There's enormous information asymmetry. Nowadays, with the kinds of things that people buy so complicated, there's always information asymmetry. You don't know what the hell's in the computer you're buying. It's just that we rely on competition to drive out the bad products or the overpriced products. But you're basically closing your eyes and picking. You don't know. You're relying on the opinion of some expert. The problem with healthcare is that the stakes are much higher. You're never going to know as much as the doctor does, no matter how much work you put into making a decision. The stakes are incredibly high, and characteristically, people are making these decisions when they are decidedly not at their best. They're sick. They're worried. It's crazy to think that you can turn, just by giving people skin in the game, it's going to enable them to make wise decisions about their medical care. And it's easy, in fact, to see that the opposite will happen. If you have skin in the game, you're probably not going to have the annual checkup that might end up in the long run saving, money that's orders of magnitude greater than what these checkups cost, not to mention improving the quality of your life by keeping you healthy. I think that paternalism is just inevitable, and you just want to, what you do want to do when it comes to healthcare is make it so that doctors don't get incentivized to do things that are unnecessary and grotesquely expensive. And the fee-for-service system, it in effect encourages doctors just to throw procedures at people.
I want to step back and talk about this sort of the dynamic in this paradox of choice. I mean, you talk about basically there are two types of people who approach choice, maximizers and satisficers, I think, if I'm pronouncing that. Break that down for us, and as we talk about sort of this dilemma that we have with the sort of the abundance of wealth that exists in our Western societies.
Well, so first of all, it's, I mean, I talk about them as if there is a dichotomy, but it's really more of a continuum. But if you're a maximizer, you are out to find the best doctor, the best cereal, the best restaurant, the best vacation, the best job, you name it. You want the best. Now, the only way to know you've got the best is if you examine every option. And in the world we live in, that's essentially impossible because there are just too many options. If you are instead a satisficer, you are not looking for the best. You're looking for a good enough option. Now, you can have low standards about what counts as good enough or high standards, but the point is that whatever those standards are, as soon as you encounter something that meets your standards, you stop looking. So the maximizer is particularly plagued by all the options that are available, since your task is to, in looking for the best, is to check out all the options. The satisficer is less plagued by all the options that are available because there's no reason for you to look at all the options. As soon as you find one that meets your criteria, the search is over. So, you know, my colleagues and I have done research showing that people who are out to find the best do better in decisions and feel worse about how they've done.
So they do find that best, whatever it is that they're trying to find. But because they are they tortured by those that sort of remain on the table, or is it simply the process has just been so painful?
It's both. They're tortured by the things that remain on the table, or even worse, by the imagined things that might remain on the table that they haven't found. You know, you get a job, you've looked at a lot of job notices, and you've applied for a lot of jobs, and you get a job. Is this the best job you could possibly get? Have you scoured the country? Have you scoured the world? Have you examined every possible job? Well, of course not. So you get this job, and it's, you know, you start thinking, well, maybe I could get paid a little more there, or maybe I'd have better colleagues there, or this, that, and the other thing, and you end up beating yourself up, convinced that somewhere out there is an option that's better than the one you chose. So the process is certainly laborious and anxiety-provoking, but there's also this fear that you have left something on the table somewhere that would be better than the thing you've chosen. And satisficers don't worry about either of those things.
That concept I find fascinating because I think that in my general life I tend to be one of those maximizers. So I'm sort of serially unsatisfied on some level, and it is also paralyzing. And it does describe that to go back to that John Barth End of the Road. They actually have a therapy that they talk about where the patient sits in a bolted chair next to the therapist, and the patient's talking about the choices involved and where to put your arms, and it's overwhelming because the aggregate of the choices of where to place your arms is always more desirable than where you end up placing your arms.
I read that book a million years ago. I have to reread it.
Oh yes, I think you got to revisit that because it describes the dilemma of the maximizer. Perfectly. It starts off with a guy sitting paralyzed in a location. But so, I mean, if that's the case, I mean, this the infinite choice. I mean, what is? Does one get fixed? Does society need to be fixed in that situation, or is it simply the maximizer needs to be fixed in that situation?
Well, I think that's a complicated question to try to answer. If we had the pill that would turn maximizers into satisficers, then the choice problem that I write about would largely take care of itself.
They don't call that Lexapro, do they?
Well, I don't know what it is. I've gotten, since the book came out, I've gotten, I don't know how many, hundreds and hundreds of emails from people telling me that I've described them to a T and they're tortured and this, that, and the other thing, and what can I do to fix this? And I don't know the answer to that. I think that just being aware of it and that it may be a source of a lot of your unease is the first step toward adopting strategies to control it or eliminate it. Nobody is a maximizer about everything. So everybody knows how to use a different standard. The question is using the decision-making style that you already use in some domains and extending that to other domains, right? When you go to the post office to get stamps, unless you're really sick, you're not looking for the best stamp. You just want stamps.
That's true.
So that means you know how to do it. You know how to settle for good enough. Well, okay, you know how to do it with stamps. How about cereal? You know how to do it with cereal? How about, I don't know, a cell phone? So you gradually build up domains where good enough is what you're after. And people, you know, it's hard at first. And people tell me that they develop new habits over time, and they feel incredibly liberated. First of all, there's much less angst associated with making decisions, and there's much more satisfaction with the decisions they end up making. So I think it's probably fixable, but not without a certain amount of pain on the part of the person who's trying to change their habits. But it would also help a lot, given that we have a distribution of people, some of whom insist that only the best will do, if we kind of organize things so that people didn't face so many options.
Well, I mean,
you know, this was Apple's great insight. Don't give people a million options. How many models of the various computers they sold did they make? So you didn't face a complicated decision. You faced a simple decision among a small number of alternatives. And it was also simple to use. And I think that that was one of its appeals. It wasn't just that it was really cool looking and sexy. It was also that it was remarkably friendly, both to purchase and then to use.
Now, my sense is that I think, you know, you've made the point that this is something, I mean, this seems to be, I mean, in the span of human development, a fairly new dilemma, right? I mean, this is a function of technological advances and whatnot. And I wonder, I mean, please talk about that aspect of it. And I also wonder whether or not the increasing income inequality also plays into this. Go ahead.
Well, let me just say that I say this almost every time I talk about this idea, is that the problem I'm worrying about and writing about is a rich person's problem. This problem is not the problem that the overwhelming majority of people in the world face. This is the problem of affluence. Most people in the world have too few choices. A small number of extremely affluent people who happen to live in places like the United States and Europe have too many choices. So the richer society gets, one of the things that limits choice in effect for people, no matter how many options are out there, one of the things that limits your choice set, your effective choice set, is what your income is. If you don't have that as a constraint, then the whole world is open to you and the problems I write about surface. So I think that the income inequality or wealth inequality, which is even worse, just all that does is it creates one set of people in society who have too many options and one set of people who don't have enough options. And there they are, you know, elbow to elbow. It seems to me, aside from it being unjust, is a recipe for real social unrest and upheaval.
I
don't think that's specifically about the choice problem. I think that's about every aspect of one's daily life.
But does it? I mean, if one has a maximizing sensibility and one is aware that these other options exist, but they're not necessarily within your reach at this moment, I mean, does this become sort of a means in which, you know, look, we have increased productivity of workers, and presumably they're chasing after something that is almost unattainable in some respects, not just unattainable in the sense that wealth, but some measure of happiness that is equated with the accumulation of things. And I wonder how much that plays into this and drives it.
Well, it's a great question. You know, how much is another way of putting this is and this is not really so much about choice specifically, is how much is enough, and how do we assess whether we have enough stuff, enough money, enough choice. And I think inevitably this is a social comparison process that enables us to answer this question. So enough is evaluated by comparing yourself to the people next to you, except that because of the explosion of media, it's not just necessarily the people next to you. It's anybody whose life you get to observe, which can be pretty much anybody. So I think enough is a moving target, is what I'm saying. And another problem with wealth and income inequality is that the target keeps moving up, except that for the majority of people in this country, all that's happening as the target moves up is that it's moving further and further away from where they are and where they can reasonably hope to be.
And I mean, it seems to me that on many of the decisions, that begins to put even more pressure on those choices, right? I mean, because if I know that wealth inequality will raise prices of housing stock, let's say. So that choice for me on my 401k becomes that much more important. Right? That I have a secure income source when I am older, or that choice as to what school do I send my kid to, because they're living in a society where it is becoming more and more competitive in some way, or that's...
I think that's right. I think the stakes of almost every decision have gone up the sort of the safety net, the effective safety net has eroded. The stakes of every decision go up. If I don't take care of my family, nobody's going to take care of my family. And I think it's not accidental that on average, the well-being of people living in Northern Europe is higher than the well-being of people in the United States, although their incomes are a little bit lower. It's because of many of these big decisions, these highly consequential decisions, there's a real cushion provided by the state. You know, your kid can get a college education. Your kid can go to the doctor. Making more money means they live a more comfortable life, but the essentials of life are there for any citizen in society just because they're citizens in the society. They're having their problems with that now as they become more diverse ethnically and racially and in education level. But what that does is it keeps the stakes of many of the decisions we make lower, because if we make the result of a bad decision is not a catastrophe.
I mean,
here in this country, it kind of is a catastrophe.
And that's got to affect that maximizer satisficer dynamic as well, right?
We don't have any data that it does, but it might. You know, when you have this feeling that that you're living in what the economist Robert Frank calls a winner-take-all society, well, then, you know, there's a sense in which only the best will do, because unless you're the best, you fail.
Well, it's also if I choose the wrong cereal this morning, that I can recover from more than, you know, I bought the wrong box of cereal. It was $4.99. You know, I'll finish it and then I'll get a better cereal. I buy the wrong car, I'm screwed.
Yeah. No, that's right. And the sense that, you know, a lot of people have the intuition that it's crazy to be a maximizer about trivial things, but it's sensible to be a maximizer about important things. I'm not sure that's correct, but that certainly is the attitude that people have. Mm. Can I just leave this phone for about a second?
Sure.
Okay.
Jeez, he had to get a new phone. He had to better get a better phone. Right.
Hi, I'm sorry to do that. I have, unfortunately, a student coming in for an appointment.
Oh, well, not at all. But so I appreciate your taking the time. It's fascinating stuff. And
And let me just also point out, you mentioned this briefly before and I never got to it. These results about choice producing paralysis, there's controversy about them. It doesn't always happen in lab studies. That is to say, sometimes more options seem to be better for people than fewer.
And in what case?
We don't know. We don't know how to tell you. I can't tell you under what circumstances you'll get the paralysis that we've been talking about, and under what circumstances the more options there are, the better off people are. All we know is that there, it always seems to matter how many options people have. Sometimes it seems to matter in a positive way, and sometimes it seems to happen in a negative way, and the research has not yet figured out what determines whether choice will be paralyzing or liberating. So I just want to be fair to people who are listening to this and not give them the impression that this is simply a settled issue and there's no debate or controversy about it.
Interesting. Well, Professor Barry Schwartz, thank you so much for your time. The books are The Paradox of Choice, Why More is Less, and How Market Freedom Erodes the Best Things in Life, among your other books. I appreciate you taking the time with us today.
I wish I could spend more time. Great talking to you. You asked wonderful questions.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Take care.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. So I would recommend it. If you find this stuff interesting, the book is End of the Road by John Barth. I think it was first issued in 1958 and then again in 1967. I think I've told people the story of my own literal paralysis at one point, right literally hours before I read that book. And it was fascinating. It was the one thing I wanted to do back in the day was to make that into a movie. But they had made a movie about it. It was a weird movie. It wasn't so great. Stacy Keach. Yeah, I know. You guys don't even have an idea what I'm talking about. This is all the way back in the 1960s. Ladies and gentlemen. What's that?
Choose not to know about that.
That's good.
There you go.
Yes. Why muddy the waters?
That's right.
Any measure of history.
Huh?
I don't look. I don't
read
know anything
Professor
that
Schwartz.
Happened before 1960. So,
there you go.
Folks, just a reminder: this show relies on your support to continue. Just yesterday, was it? Andrew Sullivan announced that he was retiring from blogging. I think I could have told you that we'd be around longer than him. aside from the fact that I wasn't necessarily – I mean, look, you know, there's a lot of people out there who say he was so generous to me as a young writer and blah, blah, blah. You know, the guy may be a good guy, but I'm sorry. From a public – I only judge people who I know through their public writings, but even if I knew him personally, here's what I do. When I know someone personally, yeah, maybe on the better half of the show, I'll say, I think that guy's a nice guy or whatnot. But for someone who is relevant for what they do as a public figure, that's on what you judge them on. And I'm sorry, I still remember the lead up to the Iraq War, among other things. He also was the editor, I think it was, of the New Republic when, in fact, he made the decision to run, was it excerpt from the bell curve or to have some type of format, some type of debate as to whether or not the question, and this is what they'll say after. At the time they made the decision, I guess the bell curve came out and they had, I think it was a forum or where they ran excerpts of it in their magazine where they allowed both sides to argue whether or not African-Americans simply were genetically inferior when it came to intelligence. And the argument is, hey, we had the debate. We had more pieces criticizing that theory than not. And I'm sorry. You know, we're going to probably play in the better half of the program today a clip of Brian Fisher, who apparently just got fired from the AFA, where he was making the argument that it was really the gays. The gay the gays were really the ones who set up the Nazi Party and were driving its brutality. Now, look, we could say, like, hey, let's have a debate. We're going to have four people on who are going to say that's not the case, and we're only going to have two who say that was the case. Or we could do what we do, and we're just going to mock it mercilessly. All right? Because if we take this really merits, this really warrants a real discussion, we are giving it more credit. So, yes, we're going to play it, and we're going to amplify his voice, and we're going to amplify his voice just to mock it, so that if anybody ever hears his voice again, they will instantaneously recall our mocking of it and will never be received without that. As opposed to put it in the context of a fair or a distinguished or a respectable debate, because I don't want anybody to ever associate this guy's words with anything that is respectable. Okay, so when I look back at Andrew Sullivan's career, whether it's that at the New Republic or whether it's him saying that, like, liberals were a fifth column, is that what he said, I think, in the Iraq War? Like, we were really sort of trying to undercut the United States by questioning going into Iraq. I know he's since come around on it. Big deal. Big deal. I don't give a crap. So in that respect, all I say is goodbye. Nice knowing you. But I raise it only, his swan song, only for the most selfish reasons, in which to argue, you know, this is not easy to maintain an independent media outlet. He was blogging and, you know, talked about the stress of it and the difficulty of it. And I think, you know, Atreos put a piece the other day where he said something. Every time he posts something, the moment after he publishes it and it goes live, the next thing he's thinking is, what am I going to post next? And that's probably the hardest thing about this job, is as soon as the show is over, the next thing that we're thinking is, who's going to be the guest tomorrow? Who, you know, what's the story we're going to do next? And but the idea is that, you know, and that's why these operations generally are much, much larger. So if you enjoy what we do on a daily basis and have the ability to support this program, please do at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, of course, if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do, it costs you nothing. And it won't even take any more time. All you get is a one-time thing. You go to majoritireportkickback.com, click on the link, click on the Amazon link there, bookmark it. Always buy your crap from Amazon there. We get a little kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, 10% off with the coupon code MAJORITY. Great coffee. Great coffee. And if you're somebody who gets your own intranet, you know, go check out igloosoftware.com/majority. Yeah, always help our sponsors. All right. See you in the better half. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. If you want to be a part of this program, you can also IM me through the app at majorityapp.com. Get the app. Or you can IM me on your instant messaging client, Majority FM. Oh, in the better half, we got the sound. I'm going to talk about the show tonight. Oh, I wish I could tell you guys how I did. But you'll find out tonight.
And you could talk about it tomorrow.
Maybe I will. All right, we'll be right back.